In this podcast, I'm going to talk about a concrete model of the atom. So why would you want a model of the atom to start off with? Well, if you do have a good model of the atom, you can understand how things are made. You can, importantly, understand organic molecules and how we're structured and how you actually work. If you've got a concrete model, that's one that you can touch and feel. Although it may not be perfect, it can start you along the journey of understanding. And incredibly inside you are cells, and inside those cells are molecular bridges or highways, and along those highways are little robots which walk around your cells. And a lot of people don't talk about them or don't understand them because they're missing this stepping stone into understanding a lot of science, which is a more robust, realistic model of the atom. This is Peter Hill Explains. I call it the universe of explanations, where I discuss things scientific. Now let's start off. It's probably about 2 o'clock out here in Australia. It's just stopped raining. The skies are clear. And I'm just going to settle down and start trying to talk about all the little components. Now, I'm on cardiac rehab. I'm a teacher. I'm trying to learn how to, through the art of podcasting, create images in your mind and educate people. So it's not perfect. I'm trying, and hopefully as you listen, I'll slowly improve. So one of the things of improving is starting off defining things such that you may understand them, building things that you know, and just developing pictures in your mind, and eventually going on to the maths and the science, wrapping it up and giving you a little product. So again, in this one, I'm going to give you an idea of making atoms. Incredibly, we're going to make atoms out of Play-Doh or clay. Play-Doh is a mixture of a lot of salt, flour, I think tartaric acid, an oil. You cook it up together and add food dye, and you get this fairly cheap clay, modelling clay that you can use to model our atoms. And we'll start off by looking at what is an atom. So a lot of people will know this already, but let's cover this as the basics. The atom is the comes from the Greek a, cannot, tome, means cut, I can't cut. And it's the smallest indivisible unit of matter. Now, in quantum physics, what it actually means is that the bits that you cut off the atom, like an electron, turn out to be as big as the atom itself. And we'll have to get into quantum mechanics to describe that. There's a few things which you hold dearly of models that and your macroscopic world you'll have to let go of. And although we're talking about quantum mechanics and a lot of waves, I'm going to handle the Schrodinger wave equation such that the actual waviness that you actually think about in terms of moving waves are separated out. But let's get back into it. An atom, like hydrogen, helium, there's 80 stable atoms and about 100 atoms all up that we know of. And they have the same basic structure, and that is a nucleus with, most of the mass inside the nucleus. And the nucleus is incredibly tiny. The nucleus contains protons, which have positive charge, and neutrons, which have have no charge whatsoever. There's a lot more that we could say about these things. And the classic model, I'm not going to go away from the confuse you, I'll talk about the classical model at the moment. And I do say the classical model because a lot of these things I described are called classical. And they're not part of quantum mechanics. The classical model has the nucleus as a tiny dot, and if you zoom in on it, The dot is made out of all these balls clustered together like grapes, but the balls are sort of randomly spaced, neutrons and protons. And when we get into quantum mechanics, this picture is not at all true. In quantum mechanics, yes, it is very small, but it doesn't look like that. And so this is small. And in our classical model, we have something called a classical electron, which has got a negative charge. And in your nucleus, if you have, say, seven protons, the central charge will be plus seven, and this will require seven electrons that will travel around the nucleus. Now, an electron is roughly 1/2000th of the mass of a proton, so therefore the smallest atom that you can make up is of one proton and one electron. That forms a neutral atom, and that atom is called hydrogen. And the electron compared to the proton, as I've said before, weighs 1/2000th, roughly. That's something that we have just measured. We have, through experiments, we have skimmed off electrons, and then we have put them in a sort of a magnetic electric field balance and actually weighed their comparative mass compared to protons. So we know that they're very light, and then we have done another thing, is we have got atoms and we have fired nuclei into it, and we have discovered the classical view is that the atom is mostly empty space, which is, I'm going to have to contradict this later on in the model that we build, but the classical view is that because particles can actually fire right through atoms, the atoms must be mostly empty space, otherwise they'd hit these hard electrons and bounce off. So the way this was done is a very thin gold foil was made by Ernest Rutherford, 1911 is the time, and he fired alpha particles, which are helium nuclei, which is two protons and two neutrons, and he fired them through this gold foil, and majority of the particles went straight through the foil and went straight through without bouncing off, and occasionally one would hit. So if you can imagine a tree with which you put little bells on the tree, and you blindfold yourself and you just start throwing marbles at the tree. If the bells are very large, overall you'll hear a lot of tinkles. If the bells are very small, you'll hear very few tingles. And what we, what Rutherford found, is that really something like one in a million and one in 10 million particles actually did hit these bells. So he concluded, perhaps wrongly, wrongly as far as quantum mechanics is concerned, that the electron's really small and the electron is mostly empty space. And now we come to build our classical school electron, and this is an electron or an atom, a schooled atom, and this is something that we are going to walk away from and start playing a different game. But the school electron is, say, if you have your clay or Play-Doh, you pick up a small quantity, about, say, roll it in the size of a marble, put it down, and then you have to have, say, for the sake of argument, make that a red for a proton. Around the outside of this, you get a very, very tiny little skerrick of yellow clay, and that will be your electron. And in the classical model, that electron will try, because it's negative and the proton is positive, those two things should slam together. But we call for magic belief, or basically brainwash people into saying this doesn't happen. So the only reason it wouldn't happen, this is the electron fall into the proton and just form an electron-proton little, a little unit. Why it forms and it goes around is basically brainwashing. We say this tiny little electron orbits around the outside and there's a attraction between the two. Now, that's the classical model that you would build at school. And if you wanted to build a more complex atom, you'd put more neutrons and protons in the inside and then an equal number of electrons to protons on the outside. The different number of neutrons determine the isotope of your atom. The unique number of protons in your nucleus determines the type of element it is. So if it's got six protons in the nucleus, it's carbon. If it's got 10 protons in the nucleus, it's a neon style of gas. Now, the way that we can model it, so this is physical models. So what we're talking about is a physical model that you can keep inside your head and start to apply to the real world. That's the idea of a model. This is something, way that you can structure a group of concepts and take that group of concepts en masse and take it and apply it. So you can apply one aspect and then you can say, oh, look, all my other concepts are bound together with this general idea of the model. Now, there's a whole lot of things that would be happening. One of the ideas is that the electrons are orbiting and going in a circular, to start off with a circular orbit, and somehow never crashing into the atom. So you could build a model of this by actually pretending that your head was the nucleus and have a small clump of dough on a string, and the string is actually not part of the atom, but the string represents a force. And as you swing the string around the outside of your head, you'll feel the acceleration that you are applying to the little model electron, that little piece of yellow dough. Tug on your string, and the electron will feel that string also tug on it and put it in a circular orbit. This tugging, this tension, is our model, our representation of the electric field. Alternatively, you could actually charge up your head, and you could actually charge up that little piece of dough such that you could launch it and it would orbit your head. It's very similar to the way that the moon orbits the Earth, and it's a very accessible model because we see the sun orbiting the Earth. The moon, did I say the sun orbiting the Earth? What have I come across? The Earth orbiting the sun. So we've got a very concrete picture of what's going on. Now, of course, the Earth and the moon, they spiral in and out. They can, over time, they drift outwards. And this is not allowed in this electron model. And so we say, oh, look, quantum mechanics, no, it can't move. So we, in effect, brainwash people not to ask questions. If someone asks a question, will this electron spiral around, radiate, bounce off things? Why would it stay forever in this state? And the essential thing is that we do a lot of brainwashing of kids to not ask that question. But if they do ask that question, we'll go up this, a new direction. One of the things I want to stop at this point in time is talk about the peculiar thing of a proton without an electron. That's a hydrogen ion. This is a marvellous thing in chemistry, in that this is incredibly small. So a proton is a billion times smaller than an atom. So it's a tiny, tiny speck compared to an atom. And this is real. So protons are incredibly tiny and incredibly mobile. And so there's a whole branch of chemistry to do with the motion of these protons. Electrons, we sort of feel, are very small, and they are very mobile. But it would be a mistake to tell you that they are very small. So we break now here. We've got a basic model that we've built of Play-Doh to make an atom and an electron. And we're going to break now and have a little bit of a theory discussion, and then talk about the Schrodinger wave equation. And you'll have to bear with me. So I do well understand that school students may not be able to understand this. I think high school or final year high school students and university students, people who are interested in the field, will be able to understand me. So quantum mechanics basically has a few fundamental rules of thumb, things that you can say instantly. One is that quantum mechanics does not have hard surfaces. So that means that your marble or lump of Play-Doh or clay is not going to model quantum mechanical, what are called wave functions. And they are, in fact, wave functions. These, if you imagine a very soft cloud-like things which you can actually pass your hand through. That's probably another aspect of quantum mechanical wave functions, them not having a definitive surface, and also not occupying space completely. So what I mean by that is that the electrons put into an atom, they occupy space, but each electron occupies the same space. You can have many electrons occupying the same space. So as I digressed to point out that a proton is very small, I'm going to digress about electrons occupying the same space. Where you can see this is any shiny piece of metal. The shiny piece of metal is, you're actually looking at very large electrons. I'm sorry, here I'm out at night, there's a coal train coming past. If you're looking at a piece of metal, you're actually seeing very large electrons, billions of overlapping large electrons. So first thing is I'm going to say is this model that you're going to be introduced to is a very physical, real model. It explains what you can see. You can see metal. Metal is shiny. You can see the sea of electrons. The electrons are actually very large, and each electron is, actually, fact, the way it interacts with light, is quite silvery. This luster is electrons, or free electrons in a metal or molten. When I say free electrons, they go between billions and billions of nuclei. So the electron expands and covers the entire nucleus. In the theory, which really doesn't hold too much, we have an idea of the electrons being tiny little dots which travel in this network of nuclei. There's a couple of things why that doesn't work, but it also doesn't explain what you can see, this large thing. So we've covered so far in quantum mechanics the fact that the fundamental unit thing that you're working with is something called a wave function, and we'll get into it. And it doesn't have a surface, It slowly ramps up, reaches the maximum, and ramps down again. It's a sort of like a gassy sort of cloud, if you want to imagine it. It also, as we've said before, doesn't occupy space definitively. Things can actually sit through each other. This is something to really get your mind around, and I can explain it a bit more powerfully. The third aspect of it is that lighter things contain more physical space. And so, just talking about, say, the electron is 2,000 times lighter than a proton. And so in the X, Y, and Z direction, it's 1,000 times larger. Its mean surface, the point at which there's, if you can imagine, a bubble within which there's more than 50% of the electron, that is 2,000 by 2,000 by 2,000 times bigger. It's 8 billion times a larger volume than the proton. And this is an important thing to get your mind into. A neutrino, which is a fantastic little particle, it's got no charge. It's just a chargeless electron. It's got very, very small mass. It's got a very large volume, in fact. So the neutrinos, which are streaming from the sun, so I'm actually being doused, even though it's at night, I've been doused with neutrinos coming through the sun, because what happens is that they go from the sun straight through the earth, straight through me. So these particles are quantum particles and can actually travel through you. They're also very large, and I've at various times calculated that they're larger. If you were to slow them down, they could grow to the size of basketball. There's another train coming through. I have to forgive if there's any backwards sound here. And one of the strange things is that these quantum particles, that when you fire them, they don't lose volume, they stretch out. And this is one thing to get your mind around. But enough of this. This is the introductory theory level. The next sort of level I want to do is actually get into the Schrödinger wave equation and what physically is a wave function. So the Schrödinger wave equation is simply this, is H psi, the Hamiltonian, the energy operator on psi, equals E, the energy of psi. So first off, we have to say that how do you operate on psi? What is psi, and what does this equation mean, and how can we operate on it? And so, very quickly, we haven't got too far away. I've sort of described the properties of psi, and now I'm going to give you a bit more of a mathematical picture of exactly what psi is. Psi is something called, a scalar. A scalar existence field, and when something exists, it's got the property of it. And when I mean scalar, I mean it has a number associated with it. It can be a complex number, but it has a number associated with it. And a field means that I basically take all points of space, and at any point of space, if I get a pink point of space and measure it, there's a quantity there. So how to imagine this? I think we're going to stretch your imagination a bit. I'm not going to fill up your mind with a picture of a big block of Lego, where the Lego blocks are built up. I'm going to get you to actually imagine the X, Y, and Z coordinate system, and a little unit box, which can get smaller and smaller and smaller. So the first unit box starts off at 0, 0, and it's got one corner at 111, they're the XYZ coordinates. And so if you can imagine space divided up into all these unit boxes, I'm going to go across rather than say it has a value at that space, at that point at 111. I'm going to say psi has an occupancy of that unit volume, because that's an obvious way to actually get you to go from the wave function to a physical model. So what that means is that if I have space, I have psi, so much a psi of an electron, and that means I can take the electron. This is a bit different. Okay, normally you're told the electron's a tiny little dot. I'm telling you the electron is a bucket. You've got a bucket in your mind, and you've got a space, and you can put tiny bits of that electron in every little unit box of space. So you can imagine a unit box of space at 50, 30, 13 in space, and in that box I'll put a tiny fraction of electron. Now, for the moment, we're going to put something called the square of psi in each of those little spaces. We're allowed to do that. And if I have, say, the electron's got a mass of a kilo, I've put it up, and I will, as I withdraw from my conceptual bucket and put it into space, I can actually construct a electron in space, and it will occupy all those little boxes. And each little box, when I sum them all up, will add up to that kilo if that goes up. So we have this fundamental thing. Because psi can be complex, we have to do a little unit, a little trick to it, to actually sum it up and audit it, so to speak. We have to multiply psi by its conjugate, which is, if I have so that size, when we're talking about a conjugate, if we take a small little unit of space, the conjugate is the negative of the complex number associated with it. So if it was the conjugate of 1 plus I, the conjugate of that would be 1 minus I. The net result of that is that if I multiply psi by its conjugate, or for that tiny little box, that's 1 times 1 plus 1 times, I plus I times minus I, that's also plus 1, and the cross product of those, that multiplication goes to 0. You'll have to do the maths of it. So one of the laws is that if I've got this entire blob of space where I've put psi inside it, I've actually created a wave function. We have this law saying that, accounting-wise, I have actually spread my electron over a large area, and psi times psi conjugate, psi star we call it, will equal 1. That's that. There's one electron there. So your electron with a charge can actually be cut up very finely and spread over a large volume. And this is true. This is just so true about what an electron actually looks like. And so this is a fundamental guide, getting your wave from an electron as a point to electron as a wave function. And why we call it a function is that the electron is physically a wave, and I can have a function which describes that volume of space. So this is something I suppose people find difficult to say. The wave function describes the distribution of psi in that space. It's a piece of nomenclature, or the way that people talk about things, which can often get people confused, because you write down a wave function and people say, well, that is it. That is the descript. It's not, it isn't it. It's not. Say, typically it's e to the minus x squared. It's a Gaussian function, and that's, in fact, is the most basic wave function that you can have. A Gaussian function goes e to the minus x squared. It gracefully goes down to zero. And it's this is a point to make things a little bit hard for newcomers to understand. When we say it is Gaussian, we really mean the description of the electron in space is described by a Gaussian function. It's hard to get your mind around. So electrons have a Gaussian function, and indeed. We go back to the Schrödinger wave equation, and we say, if I do some mathematical operators, so some mathematical operators may be squaring it, or maybe differentiating. So how do I do a differentiation in space? Well, I consider I can do differentiation in each dimension, and the way I do it is I look at the amount of psi, say, for instance, on the x-axis at 4 out, and I look at the distance at 5 out. I subtract those two differences, and then I then have for that psi a new function, a new conceptual function of the amount at 5 minus the amount of 4 put in at the point of 4.5. So if it's decreasing as I go out, it'll be actually a negative amount of stuff. So this is one of the things to get your mind around. The actual units that I actually cast out into space can be negative, they can be complex numbers, they can be anything you want. It's just at the end of the day, after you've filled up space the way that you want it, you have to sum all that space and put it together, and this gives you something called a object, which is described by a three-dimensional function, a scalar field, which is described by a three-dimensional function. Please hang with me for a while. You can fast forward or listen to this many times over, the reason I know all of this is that I've done quantum mechanical modelling on supercomputers, so I've had to actually divide equations, push it through to get things out, and I suppose, this is philosophically, in order to do that I've had to admit my ignorance, and admit the ignorance of other people, these people who are lecturers and very boisterous and don't describe things in practical terms, and they sort of dodge the fact that they don't really understand it deeply. So I've got this deep understanding, which has, I suppose, led me around the corner of thinking, and then I have to sort of walk back all the time to try and tell people about what's around the corner. So we've got the idea of a scalar field, which is described by a wave, a function, and that function, if we constrain it in a certain way, can only be a certain class of function called a wave function. And that means fundamentally it has to obey a wave equation, which is the Schrödinger wave. The Schrödinger wave equation. The Schrödinger wave equation is simply the Hamiltonian times psi equals E times psi. So what this means is that I can apply a few functions to this three-dimensional object, and that will produce another three-dimensional object. And what the fundamental idea is that I have this function, and One of the restrictions is that if I apply this function to this object, the answer has to be a clone of this object. So if you can imagine, I have a basketball or a cat or anything else, like I can construct anything in space which looks like this object, and we're going to take a punt at doing this. I apply this thing called Hamiltonian to it, which describes its energy, and it means that I produce the object again. And with scale factor. The scale factor is called the energy. And this loop, continuous loop of idea, is the Schrödinger wave equation. And you'll have to look at it and try and get into it. Now, the Schrödinger wave equation, the actual Hamiltonian, talks about differentiating the wave function and weighting the wave function by another scalar field. Or it can actually be a vector field if you really, really want to. You can actually add in them, but a scalar field. And this is a bit of a tamer scalar field. It hasn't got the restrictions on it. It has a field which says, when I say it's a field, in space you've got units. It's got a value at each point in space. So it might be the electric field around a proton. It means that so many, any distance from the proton, there'll be a force on the electron. So this is a little bit different from your Newtonian view of stuff. But when you actually come to when you go into it, it's just beautifully the same. So let's have a little look. You've got your proton sitting in the middle of your electron, this large scalar field, and you have the description that the electron, say, a million billionth of an electron is the amount of the electron at a little point in space out there, and that will have an energy. And you could also say a force acting on it equal to a million billionth of the force of a whole electron. It's a tiny fraction. Now, the fact is that this adds up for the whole electron. It adds the whole electron cloud, if you like. Now, what I don't like about a cloud is that it's all the particles are... It's not a single unit. This is a single unit. And so you've got the combination of a scalar field of existence, and the scalar field of existence is the phase. It could be plus, minus, complex numbers, and it just has to add up when you square it. When you take the square of it, that phase, that adds up to the weight of an electron. But that electron has one charge, but that charge is distributed. So, amazingly, the electron can be large, and it can distribute its charge, and an electron can change shape and all these beautiful, beautiful things when you get to an electron. And this is truly the beauty of quantum mechanics. And we're going to stop at the moment and just review what the psi looks like. So, psi... doesn't have a surface. Psi can of a particle can exist through another particle. In fact, psi, if you like to think of it, is like vibrations in a string. So you can actually get many different notes and vibration frequencies going on at the same time. If you like hearing something clatter, it's lots of different frequencies going at the same time. So you can have lots of psi sitting through each other in space. And also, the lighter psi is, the bigger it is. And this comes back from the Schrödinger wave equation, which comes back that the basically the curvature of a function reduces as the mass reduces, so the actual way at which that function becomes crinkly, can actually crinkle, is limited by the mass. So if it's got low mass, it's got low crinkliness, and if it's got low crinkliness, you can't actually bend it sufficiently to actually fit in a small space. And this is why electrons are so large. And then we have the Schrodinger wave equation, which gives it out here. Now, you're going to have to trust me at this stage. There's certain beautiful things we can do. One very first thing you can do is called the Born-Oppenheimer. That's right, the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which says, look, electrons are light, the wave functions of electrons can move sufficiently that we can actually consider the function of the nucleus separate from the function of the atom. And look, it is an approximation, and it does break down at various points in time, leading to gaps when the energy curves cross. Just put that in their memory to hear at some stage. So there's the Born-Oppenheimer equation, and the idea of one of the things you do have when you have an electron orbiting a nucleus in the old model, this is in the classical model, you have time. Obviously, the electrons at different points at different times. Now, the Schrodinger wave equation actually handles this supremely beautifully, because the time and spatial coordinates can separate out. So essentially, you have a energy solution to your Schrodinger wave equation, which is EI to the E something or other. It's just a unit. I'm saying this sitting down here, couldn't sleep, so I'm just saying this off the top of my head. So I haven't read notes or anything like that. I'm just data dumping at the top of my head, and I hope that you can follow so far. So the time dependent equation is you get your energy, and then you just multiply your fixed wave function is by this e to the minus et, I think it is, and this actually adds a spinning phase of complex numbers to whatever you solve. So you can take that out and actually throw it away or put it onto the side and reduce your wave, your psi. I call it a psi. A psi is an occupancy of space, and the amplitude of it is the actual, it's a wave, so it starts off and oscillates, and you square it to get its existence, and you've got that physical part, and you can throw that off and solve the actual spatial part, and the time part comes to you for free. So this massively simplifies dealing with the Schrodinger wave equation and visualizing it. So it's not all hard yakka. Or hard yakka is the Australian word for work. So it's a yakka or a yoni, mate. So what that means is I'm going to lift a stone. It's hard yakka. Where that word comes from. So that's an Australian word which has come through. So it's not hard work going through. So we've got H psi equals E psi. So another way of saying this, all the way I calculate the energy times a function. When I say a function, a distribution of stuff in space equals a number, say 4 times psi. And we take off the time component, it means that the Schrodinger wave equation means that for an energy field, energy scalar field, where something is attracted to, say an electron is attracted to a proton, I can have set shapes of electrons which fulfill this condition. and that condition is fulfilled at certain energy levels. So certain electrons can have certain energy levels and they'll have certain shapes in space associated with it. So just going off the top of my head, say if it's the psi is in a square well, a square well is like a well, you know, how do I say, you know, a well of water in the ground, that wishing well, it's got square walls. So I'm solving for that as an energy. The energy levels there just happen to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 going up. And for each of those, I can have a shape of an electron in three-dimensional space that is that stands for that. It sits in there, and this is what I did in my PhD over and over again for all these different quantum particles. Nothing flash. In fact, when you really get into it and actually start doing the experiments, you get these insights into it. And I would solve the Schrodinger wave equation and just run this function such that it didn't expand to infinity. So if you put in an unrealistic energy which isn't allowed, what will happen is your Schrodinger, your function will go off to infinity and then normalize down, crunch to zero. So your solution is the amount of possible wave function is zero. And at certain ideal functions where the wave function is behaved like a string being held at two ends, the wave will exist in three-dimensional space there. So that's the mathematical part of it, and we're getting on for a long time. I'm sort of awake at the moment and may as well talk about this. I don't know if people will listen to it. So let's recap where we're at the moment. We've talked about the classical electron and proton and what you're taught at school about them being little, the electron being a speck and the proton being comparatively big in space. And the reason we cover that is that that's introducing you to your existing knowledge, which you'll say, ah, yes, I understand that, or I have been taught that, or I haven't been taught that, I'm not going to listen to this podcast anymore. And then I've said, well, that's not good enough. You've been brainwashed into believing this. Let me tell you about quantum mechanics. And I haven't explained quantum mechanics too deeply, but I've explained the consequences of some equations and what you physically need to know about psi and how these equations are solved and the different electrons in an atom having these different shapes. And at this start, I promised that I'd get you a model. And the model I'm going to do is, it's obviously a fantastic thing to do in a computer because you can just get an array which is 1,000x, 1,000y, 1,000 z, and that quickly goes up to several gig. It's, you know, and your computer will slow on that, and you can put numbers at every point in here and start playing around with that. In fact, there are computer programs which allow you to do that. If I could just put you off, there's a free computer program that you can download on your computer called Orbital Viewer. There's also beautiful programs by Falstad which allow you to visualize it. There's some YouTubes that I've produced using these programs and LabVIEW programs to simulate these beasts, these psi. But we're talking about a physical model, and we're going to have to get physical. And the first psi, the most basic psi, so if I have a lone electron encasing, not orbiting, but encasing a proton. Now, strangely enough, look, it In quantum mechanics, it's actually not. The electron isn't moving, because if the electron is moving, it would be radiating. It has... it's not moving, yet it has momentum. So there's an operator, a momentum operator, and the momentum operator summed over all space is zero for it. This is for the basic electron. So it's got a space, and it's overall it's not moving. Parts of this electron's moving into the centre of the atom continuously as it's continuously falling into the atom as a wave. And I suppose I should also point out that the electron is actually covers all space, including existing inside the proton. Find that hard to believe? It's all true. Look it up on Wikipedia, as I think it's called the Lamb shift. Very interesting to look at. Obviously, that starts to do your head in, and people start to complain, and people just turn up the knob of brainwashing. You can either be brainwashed and successfully be brainwashed, or you can go off and do quantum mechanics. Now, I can't suggest a physical model for a Gaussian wave function, or a Gaussian psi, which is, a psi, which is described by a Gaussian field. It's the closest I could get to is perhaps a cotton wool ball or a Nerf ball, something that doesn't have a very hard surface. But practically, the way that we want to go is a little ball of Play-Doh or clay, yellow clay. I'm going to have the two colours of clay, yellow and blue, because we're going to ask you to imagine this clay is going to double as both psi star, which is the complex, the psi by its complex conjugate, or psi squared, the absolute value of psi. Yeah, that's the way to put it. Psi squared. But we're going to ask you to imagine that it is actually the phase. It can be plus or minus. But initially, I'm going to ask you to roll up a ball and say, and imagine that this ball doesn't have a surface on it, even though our model does have a surface on it. And this ball just increases intensity to maximum intensity of inside the nucleus. There you go. The most likely point for an electron to be in a hydrogen atom is inside the proton. Try and get that. Well, that's true in quantum mechanics. So ask a quantum physicist, and I don't know, they might hum and ha, but that's the actual answer. And that's not a very satisfactory answer to give a school kid, because they go off home and their parent who'd been taught in the subcontinent or Russia or someplace like that, they'll say, oh no, your teacher's mad. So you just don't say that. But I'm giving you the secrets of it. Now, what you've made there is a hydrogen atom. Now, we're just going to go in and make a helium atom. And what I'm going to ask you to do is get that ball and just take a tenth of the ball away, and that will make and roll it up, and that very tiny little thing will be a helium atom. So what's actually happened there is that the increased charge of the nucleus has increased the scalar field, electric field of it. Scalar, yeah. Yep, look, it's a scalar field. That's right. Even though it is a vector field, as far as we're concerned, the energy there is a scalar field of it, and it's created the curviness, and it's actually compressed that electron in space into a smaller volume. So that one electron is got a greater density. There you go. The electron was big, and now it's smaller. And helium's got two electrons, and by something which you're just going to have to get your mind around, we exist in a double universe. That is, yeah, we... I hope this doesn't shock you. So we have a spin-up and spin-down... spin-up and spin-down universe overlaying each other. And so the other electron, which exists in the other universe, the spin-down universe, is in there as well. It's actually been able to get in. So you've actually got two electrons of much higher density sitting in the helium. So that gives you a helium molecule. The next thing I'm going to ask you to do is that's in yellow. So there's actually two electrons, and this is stretching your mind a bit. I won't go into the symmetry there. If you want to look up about spin, what you have to do is you have to look up Dirac. You have to look up something called S2 symmetry. And if you really follow it, and I have followed it, it's spinors. And the derivation comes from space-time coordinates, from special relativity. You've got four rank vector, going through of time x, y, z, and that gives you a ranked tensor of spin-up, spin-down, matter and outing matter, if you follow it through. A bit hard to follow, but you'll just have to trust me. So your helium has two electrons, the same shape orbital, but one spin up, one spin down. Next one up is lithium. We won't go too far. We'll get say, up to carbon, and then I'll finish this godforsaken thing and go for a walk this time of night. As I prepare, I'm having an operation, or a pretty big operation, in about 36 hours' time, so I'm just sort of a bit philosophical, a bit whimsical. But we're coming across here. Next one is to make up lithium. So you're on your own here, because a lot of teachers would just, you get brainwashed or you don't. But this is a long, hard slog, my friend. Lithium, you have your... the next electron, which we put up, you go back and produce... a large yellow ball, and then on the outside of that you put a blue Play-Doh. So it's got a yellow ball inside a blue ball, and I would recommend cutting it so you can see inside. Now, this is not two separate electrons. This is the third electron coming in. We're modelling the third electron here. Indeed, this third electron is existing in space, and inside it, this third electron is the first, second, and the nucleus. It's all sitting through it in space, so we're just looking at the third electron by itself. And seeing how it sits in space. And we've got blue and yellow. And what this is truly one electron. The blue represents negative phase, and the yellow represents positive phase. And cutting through, although it's hard, and it's got a definite surface and finishing, it's got a nodal line, its first nodal line between the... of the electron. This is a radial nodal line. That's where it changes from negative to positive. That's a nodal line. And cut through it, and you can see that this is yellow and then blue on the outside. Now, at this point, it's probably good to go through the dynamic periodic table and start to click on lithium and look at the orbitals, the three orbitals involved there. Now, when you actually look at it, they'll show you a hard model, which is, again, a bit misleading. If you start to really look into models, you can see, possibly on the internet, pictures of it, and in Orbital Viewer, you can click through. Again, this is one of the misleading things that people like to show you surfaces, but everyone's content with it. If you can imagine this as a sort of a milky thing, where this is a scalar existence field. So a field says that I have a bit at every coordinate. So pressure is a air pressure is a field because there's an air pressure at every single coordinate. That's a scalar field. Temperature is a scalar field. A vector field would be the wind is pointing at a particular direction at every point. That's making me think about. Look, scalar fields and vector fields do come into when these guys, you pulsate these electrons, you make them radiate light. That's another go between orbitals. Hydrogen, lithium, beryllium. Beryllium is you got it exactly the same as lithium, but a little bit smaller. And it's the same deal. It's spin up, spin down. So beryllium's fairly interesting. Then the orbitals coming after that is hydrogen, boron, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon. Yeah, so there's boron, then carbon. Now, to do the P, so... because there's one node, if there's the principal quantum number is 1 plus the number of nodes. There you go. And the nodes can either be radial or axial nodes. And we're coming up to some axial nodes. So the P orbitals, so... S stands for sharp, P stands for principal, D stands for diffuse. These are the what they look on under the spectroscope, and F stands for fine. And indeed, when you look at these under a spectroscope, you can see immediately what they're talking about. So this is just, you know, nature making it easy for us scientists to look what's going on. The hydrogen, helium are principal quantum number 1. There are no nodes. The next one is principal quantum number of the last electron in. There you go. Last electron in of 2, and this is for lithium and beryllium. After that, you've got those electrons. The next electron added in. So trying to get this into your head that... Each time, each model you make is actually existing in the center of the previous model. So your beryllium model, you add yet another electron which slips through in space on top of all this. So try and get this into your head and look up at the dynamic periodic table. The next electron there is a P electron. And a P electron is like this. you get a ball... of yellow and a ball of blue. Yellow is positive, blue is negative. And you get a complete ball of yellow and a complete ball of blue. You cut it in two with a knife, halfway in a knife, to make a radial friction, angular node. So this is, if you like, oscillating either side. But remember, this is time-independent Schrodinger wave equation, which you can do beautifully, and you stick you then carefully cut, break these two balls which you've cut into and actually stick the yellow and the blue, and the blue and the yellow, you get two for free doing this technique, and that gives you the 2p orbital of the last electron in. So in that, it is true that the other electrons are sitting in space through this electron, and you just have to get this into your head and go and look at the dynamic periodic table. Now I'm just going to do a bit of hand waving here. When you go up to carbon, you can hybridize these orbitals. So in real life, the energy levels interact with each other, and the electrons interact with each other and just do a bargain or a deal, and you can actually create a dumbbell shaped orbital, which is called an SP3 or SP2 orbital, and form a tetrahedron. This is going a lot out of 4 electrons. So you can actually get a tear-shaped... it's a tear-shape with a little lobe on it. You'll have to look at it on the internet again. I'm sorry, this is a bit of a cop-out. I'm just trying to describe how you can model it with clay. Look, can I thoroughly recommend... like I've got the benefit of doing this on supercomputers and discovering new molecules, but modelling on clay is very worthwhile. So you can actually form this hydrogen tetrahedron, and with that start to imagine how this forms the different shapes of molecules like helium, like methane, and various other molecules. I like to, if I'm still awake, I'll still do another talk after this on esters, which is God's gift to organic chemistry. There's a limit to how much I can do, but once you're into the website called the Dynamic Periodic Table, you'll be able to shudder to think how long this podcast's going for. I hope the podcast machine's on after all this talking. You really need to reward yourself. So what I'd like you to do is after you've looked at that, I'd like you to go to the Inner Life of Cells. It's Harvard Visualizations, Inner Life of Cells, and see what the human body does with quantum mechanics. And all these molecules and atoms link together and give you shaped molecules of proteins, and we actually make molecular robots inside our cells, and so it's really worth it to see there. And of course, it's a field which just keeps on giving. It's a sort of a lonely profession, being a quantum physicist in a world full of, I suppose, very forceful, very convincing. They've got a much better personality than me. I'm a sort of a meek person who just sort of listens for a while, goes to equations, goes to computers and stuff like that. I speak to people and they say, no, no way, it's this, I was taught this at school. And you say, oh, it's out of date, and then they get angry at you. So the last thing I want you to do is to lose your friends, but and people getting angry at you, but it is worthwhile looking at it, and the equations that you get, some of the lasers that you see, and some of the substances that you can understand with quantum mechanics, just semiconductors, for instance, all that type of stuff is really worthwhile. And until you actually do this play-doh modelling and start looking at this and start recognising that electrons are bigger than protons. Yeah, this is a fundamental thing. I think if you really want to give yourself a shock, look up a classical electron. I think the classical electron last had an adherence by some religious sect who used to believe in it. So, and of course, schools teach it with aplomb. It will be rewarding. It will be a very lonely life for you. Or hopefully in future generations it won't be that way. So just to summarise once again, we've taught you the... Well, I haven't taught you. We've talked you through what's inside an atom, how we model an atom, how we model psi, a brief overview of the Schrodinger wave equation, and basically that you can separate out time, consider different fields and get psi and get an access to that. And obviously it's beyond, well, look, they're going to be a better person than me who will come out and be famous and be able to give you a mathematical equation and spellbinding the audience, giving Laplacians and all that type of physics. The physics is worthwhile. Just do a physics degree. So the different years, it's really worthwhile when it gets through. And then we've talked about how you actually model the real thing, the model in your head, this fuzzy stuff, and then this hard concrete model of plus and minus phase, the different phases goes together, and I've pointed you to a few websites to see the individual molecules and then the molecules added together to make things, and then if you do it, the enjoyment is yours. Look, it's truly, molecules are truly enjoyable to look at, especially if you see how they go, proteins and all that type of stuff, drugs, proteins. Chemical reactions are truly beautiful and interesting to see, and to see how people historically have gone about it. So that's all for tonight, signing off, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.